Welcome to Witch Hunt, the podcast bringing you news of witch hunts happening around the world now. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
I'm Sarah Jack. Today, we welcome Professor John Azuma for an interview about the effort in Ghana to legislate against witchcraft accusations and witch camps.
In this episode, we dive deep into a pressing and profoundly disturbing issue, witchcraft accusations in Ghana. We'll be discussing the social, cultural, and political ramifications of these accusations and the lives they irreparably alter.
To guide us through this intricate subject, we are joined by John Azuma, an expert in the field and an advocate for the accused. Our conversation aims to shed light on the historical context, the present situation, and the hopeful pathways to reform.
It's a conversation that challenges preconceptions, calls for empathy, and demands action. Stay tuned as we navigate through the complexities of this issue, informed by the insights of our distinguished guests.
Welcome, Dr. Azuma, founding executive director of the Sana Institute, a scholarly community dedicated to the equipping and resourcing of religious leaders, scholars, and academic institutions in wider African society through advanced inquiry.
Thank you. My name is John Azuma. I'm the executive director of the Sana Institute based in Accra. I'm originally from Ghana myself. I come from the northern part of Ghana, and I did my studies in Christian theology and in Christian-Muslim relations in the UK. And I have taught in Ghana, in the UK, in India, and then in the United States. So I am currently based in Accra as the director of the Sana Institute.
What would you like us to know about Ghana before we get into the witchcraft accusations?
Yeah, Ghana is in West Africa. It is the first sub-Saharan African country to obtain independence from Britain back in 1957. And Ghana has a very stable political climate as compared to other countries in the sub-region. We've had our share of coup d'etats in the past, but since the early 90s, Ghana has been a very stable democracy in West Africa. We do pride ourselves as a nation of hospitality. We people are very hospitable in Ghana. Recently, we had challenges with the economy and going through a lot of economic challenges. But in the sub-region where there's a lot of violence and religious extremism also, one of the peaceful features of Ghana is a very peaceful coexistence between Muslims and Christians. We are not just coexisting. We are really actually living together, engaging with one another at various levels, from the family to the national level. Our president is a Christian and our vice president is a Muslim. Ghana has about 70% Christian population and about 20% Muslim population. This is Ghana, and we have very strong historic connections with the United States of America. W.E. Du Bois is buried here. He moved here, he relocated to Ghana, and he died here, and he became a Ghanaian citizen, and he's buried here. So Ghana has a long history with the United States. And African Americans, Ghana is very special because of the slave trade. It was one of the ports from which a lot of Africans were taken to the New World, including the United States. So there's a very strong slave castle, a very popular slave castle here that many African Americans visit as a kind of a pilgrimage, if you like. Yeah. President Obama, when he became president, the first African country he visited was Ghana. And the first place he called upon was the castle, the slave castle, where he went with his wife, Michelle, and their two daughters. So that is Ghana for you. I can talk about Ghana for the whole day.
Could you provide insights on perceptions and understandings of witchcraft and witches in Ghana?
Witchcraft is a very strong belief in Ghana. All religious people, from Christian to Muslim to indigenous African believers, people believe in witchcraft. And it cuts across different social backgrounds also. and even educational backgrounds. And you have professors who believe in witchcraft. You have medical doctors who believe in witchcraft. You have police officers who believe in witchcraft, judges who believe in witchcraft, not to mention chiefs and traditional leaders and rulers. So it's widespread. And the perception in Ghana about witchcraft is that it's rooted in the fact that Ghanaians generally will want to find an explanation for every misfortune, and especially for every tragic death or misfortune, as I said, or even sickness, or even accident. And people fall on back to witchcraft as that kind of explanation for some of these things that happen. Their belief in witchcraft is that it has to do with the fact that witchcraft is an evil magical power that people possess and people acquire through different means, mainly hereditary, mainly from the female line. The mother passes it on to the daughters. Witchcraft in itself, the belief is that it can be used for good purposes. It can be used for evil purposes. When men have the powers of witchcraft, the belief is that men generally use it for good purposes. But when women have witchcraft powers, they tend to use it for evil purposes. And so my argument has always been that what that belief tells me is that the witchcraft itself is not evil in itself. It is the female gender that is being demonized here. That is because it is in the hands of the woman that the witchcraft becomes an evil phenomenon. So that is the belief. And the belief is that witches can transform themselves into some kind of creatures in the night. They can fly about and emit some light as they fly in the dark. And that's the way they move from place to place. And they congregate at vantage points. So you go to the villages and they have particular trees or rivers or bushes somewhere that they say, witches congregate there every night. And they have their meetings and they go out on their expeditions, hunting expedition. And they catch people and spiritually, and they kill people slowly, spiritually. So that is the belief in witchcraft in general in Ghana.
Where did the accusations come from? Are these neighbors or people in their families, or who is accusing other people?
Good question. Yeah, the accusations come from different sources. But principally, and this is where the shocking part of it is from family. It's from family. Family members accuse family members of witchcraft. And it's predominant in the northern part of the country where polygamy is also predominant, very common. And you go to a family where there's polygamous marriages and you find one gentleman with multiple wives and children, each woman has children, and there's a lot of competition and rivalry for resources, for all kinds of things. And that leads and lends itself to witchcraft accusation. One woman's children may be doing well and another woman's children are not doing so well, and there could be accusations of witchcraft. A child dies suddenly or even through some kind of sickness, and a rival will accuse their rival as of being the one who has bewitched their child. Family is the main source of the accusations. Meanwhile, there are also religious leaders who do the accusations. And the religious leaders who do the accusations range from pastors, imams, and indigenous spiritualists. And it happens that somebody may go to the pastor or the imam to inquire about a misfortune or a sudden death at home. And the imam or the pastor or the religious figure will tell them there's a witch in the house who is causing this. And they will not mention a name, but they will give a general description of how the witch looks like. And then leave it to the person now to go back home and figure out who fits that kind of description. And then the accusation is made. So religious leaders do that. But mainly, the accusation is from family members for the reasons that I've just enumerated.
In what ways is it determined if the person is indeed a witch?
Good. Very, very good question again. There are a number of ways. Two of the key ways that people are determined to be witches is individual dreams. People just have dreams. And I dream that some kind of animal is chasing after me, or I see someone in the family in my dream, and we have an argument or some kind of disagreement or even a fight in a dream, and I fall ill. I conclude that it is that person who is causing my illness. And sometimes sick people, even children, when they are sick, you find pressure on the family, on the sick people, to name who it is in the family that has bewitched them. So sick people can mention names, that it is my auntie, it is grandma, it is my stepmother, those kinds of things. And those are some of the ways that people are determined to be witched. One other formal way of doing it is they take the accused persons to a shrine. And the traditional priests have various ways of using traditional ritual to determine who is a witch. One of the ways they do it, cutting off the head of a chicken. So when you come, when you are accused and you are brought as an accused person, you provide the traditional priest with a chicken. You will have to provide the chicken. They will cut the head of the chicken off and throw the chicken down, and the chicken will flop, 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 flop. And if the chicken ends on its back, dying on its back, you are declared innocent. When the chicken ends up dying on its stomach, you are a witch. You are guilty. It's as simple as that. However, in many cases, even when the ritual has determined that you are not a witch, the accusers will still insist that they don't trust you, you are a witch. And that if you come back home, they will hurt you, they will harm you. As you find people ended up in some of these outcast posts that we call witch camps in the northern part of the country.
We watched a video of a webinar that you had done a few years back. And one thing that you'd mentioned that got my attention was that witchcraft suspects aren't seen as human. Can you explain that?
The witchcraft itself, as I said, there is the good part and the bad part. We don't hear people being accused of the good part of witchcraft. It's always the bad part. It's the evil part of witchcraft. So that in the technical true sense of witchcraft as it is, witchcraft is what some African scholars have called black magic. And black magic is seen to be evil. And when you are accused of witchcraft, it means you have become possessed by evil, and you have become an embodiment of evil. You are no longer functioning as a normal, rational human being. Your humanity has been taken over by the witchcraft powers. And therefore, you cease to be human. And when they label you a witch, it means that humanity has been taken out of you. And so when people talk about human rights, they are missing the point. The person is no longer human. You have to get rid of that. Evil, you don't treat evil. You don't manage evil. You destroy evil. And therefore, when you are demonized, the next step is to eliminate you. And that is what makes witchcraft accusations so dangerous. That even when people are accused of witchcraft, their own biological children will disown them. they will say that because they said, you are no longer my mom. You are now some kind of demon. And so you don't deserve that kind of empathy or sympathy from me. And that is what makes witchcraft, that's why the lynching is so common. We don't hear much of it in the media, not because it's not happening, but because people have learned to do it in secret. And that is what is so insidious and so dangerous about the belief.
We see a lot of parallels between that and the witch trials in Europe and America. They really vilified the person was in league with the devil, so they're the enemy, and then it doesn't matter what you do to them.
Yeah.
Is there any other aspects of the witchcraft accusations you'd like us to know?
The other aspect of it is that in Ghana in particular, whereas the witchcraft accusation and the beliefs are widespread across the country, areas that they call witch camps that exist in the northern part of the country, these so-called witch camps are places that the shrines exist. The shrines where they do the ritual to determine who is a witch. In fact, in other words, the shrines are the witch hunting ground. That is where they hunt for witches through the ritual that I described earlier. And what goes on there, when the women, and mostly it's women, when they are taken there, even when they are declared innocent, like I said, they're still abandoned there because the accusers will threaten them. If they get back, if they come back to the community, they'll be hurt. And so you have these camps in the northern part of the country. And when you go to these camps, the women have to fend for themselves. They've been driven out of their homes. They are basically outcasts. I call the camps dumpsters for human rejects of society. And nobody wants them back, not even their family member. The family will only go for the dead body. When the woman passes away, they will go for the dead body and go and bury it back in the village and perform the funeral. Because they believe that if you don't perform the final funeral rites of a relative, the ghost will haunt you for the rest of your life. So they will go and take the body and go and bury it and perform the funeral. And there's a lot of abuse in the camp of these women. A lot of sexual exploitation, a lot of physical abuse, not to talk about the emotional trauma that these women are put through by being driven away from their grandchildren and their families and their relations. And what is so sad about it also is another dimension is that when these women are driven into these camps, they go with minors. Sometimes the minors, their grandchildren, some will go and stay with them, especially when they are sick. They can't take care of themselves. They can't do their own linen. They can go for water. So they send a small child to go and stay with them to help them. And you find that in some places, the family want the woman back, but they are afraid of the community. So in those cases, they will send a small child to go and stay with their grandmother and take care of them. Now, these children themselves go through a lot of abuse. And they end up in child marriages a lot. Because the woman in the camp is desperate for resources, even sometimes what to eat is a problem. The people in the community around will come and say, we want to marry your granddaughter so we can help take care of you. And so you find children marrying at 12, 13, 15 years old, which means education is out of the question. So there are a lot of other side issues about this accusation that's affecting family members in ways that goes beyond the victims. And sometimes the family members are afraid to visit their family, the victims, because when you go to the camp and you come back home, the suspicion is that if you keep going and coming, you are going to end up being accused of being a witch because you keep going there and you are going to be infected by the witchcraft spirit. So there's a lot of stigma. And these children, even where there are community schools around, who live with their grandparents in the camp, they cannot attend the school because of the stigma. They tease them, they call them small witches and those kinds of offensive terms that the children end up staying at home. And Sarah, you won't believe it, but even some NGOs take advantage of this plight of these women. They write reports, they raise funding, and very, very small part of it goes to these women. Whatever gets to the women, the camp managers will take the large percentage of it. Sometimes they take all of it from the women. So Christmas time, end of year, some churches will go and make donations to the camps. And when they go and make the donations, mostly foodstuff and provisions, the camp owners will say, thank you, we will distribute it to the women. And when they leave, they either just take a full chunk and give a little to the women, or they take all of it. So a lot of exploitation and abuses going on in these camps.
We understand you've been campaigning to reform and to ban witchcraft accusations and close the witch camps. What can you tell us about that effort with getting that law passed?
We got involved directly in this campaign in 2020. July 2020, we all know what was going on in 2020. COVID period and the lockdowns and all of that. And Ghana was under lockdown, and then we were shocked. The nation was horrified when pictures began to emerge on social media about an elderly woman, 90-year-old, who was publicly lynched. And there was a crowd around who were cheering on. And the reason was she was accused of being a witch. That horrified the nation. And there were a lot of condemnations and outrage coming out from different quarters, from the presidency, from politicians, from civil society organizations, from NGOs, from human rights groups. But that wasn't the first time that something like that had happened in Ghana. It had happened before. And the same outrage. And then after a week, back to normal. When this happened, I was like, we are not going to let this go back to normal. And so the media, we got on board, we started the campaign, and we were not going to let it out of the media. We kept it in the media. And we wrote a petition to Parliament that they should pass a law criminalizing the accusation, which is the root cause of all of these lynchings. And then we got in touch with some of the parliamentarians because they said the bill had to be a private member's bill because the government was not prepared to take this bill up and sponsor it as a government bill. And therefore, we had to sponsor it as a private member's bill, which meant that we had to look for funding, to raise the funding for the campaign, and to lobby the ministers, the parliamentarians, to take it up. And we were able to do that and to get some individual parliamentarians to take the bill up, to sponsor it as a private member's bill in Parliament. We organized and took the parliamentarians to the northern part of the country to visit the camps. So they went with us. We sat with the women, interviewed the women, interacted with the traditional priests and the chiefs. And then we sponsored their meetings to discuss the draft and work through the draft and to take it through the various parliamentary processes until it was finally passed in Parliament on July 27, 2023. So it took us 3 years. This woman was lynched on July 23rd, 2020. And the bill was passed in July 2023. So exactly 3 years, almost to the day. So we were all celebratory mood. When it was passed, It was passed unanimously. And we were very glad and excited about that. But suddenly the bill hit a snag. Because as the parliament passes the bill, like it happens in other places, including the United States, the president has to sign it for it to become law. And our president said he was not going to sign it. And that became another source of campaign. As I'm talking to you now, in fact, today we issued a press statement, a coalition of us came together to issue a press statement calling on the president to sign the bill into law. Parliament itself is very upset that the president has refused to sign the bill. And the president's excuse is that the bill should have been sponsored as a government bill and not a private member's bill. When from the get-go, we were told that government could not sponsor the bill and that it could only come to parliament as a private member's bill. We are negotiating that. Thankfully, we've got the diplomatic missions, the British High Commission, and other diplomatic missions in the country who are working with us behind the scenes to put pressure on the presidency to sign the bill into law. We are in an election year, and we are campaigning to make sure the bill is signed into law this year before the election in December. But that is where we are. We haven't crossed the line yet, finally, but we are near the crossing line, and we are not going to give up at this point in time.
Does that bill include a provision for closing the witch camps, or is that a separate effort?
The bill criminalizes the existence of the witch camps. So it says that where these women are living now, the women are free to go back to their community and nobody should detain them there. That's as far as the bill has gone. As soon as the bill is signed into law, we are going to mount an education campaign to get the women to leave the camps and help them to reintegrate. Those who are able to go back to their original communities will go back. Those who still don't feel safe to go back, we settle them in different communities. And when the bill is passed into law, is signed into law, we are giving ourselves 3 years of work to close down the camps because we know it's not going to happen overnight. And we are not pretending that will happen. What will happen, though, is that when the accusations reduce, the camps will begin to dry out and there are no new victims coming into the camp. That will help. And those who are there now, we begin to resettle them gradually. And that is the work that we are focused on now.
How long have there been witch camps?
The oldest witch camp, people say, was established back in the 19th century. Mid-19th century. And it is said that it was actually established as a safe haven. It was the first one we are told was established by a Muslim cleric who was in an area and this old woman was being chased to be killed. And he came out and said, "Don't kill her. I will take her to my house and I will keep her. I will make sure that she's no longer a witch. I will take care of the witchcraft spirit." In those days, and even today, there's a lot of respect for religious figures. So when the religious figure came out and said that, they handed the woman over to him. And he started this small compound around his quarters. The numbers started growing there. And when he eventually passed, the traditional priest took over oversight of these areas. And that is how the witch camps developed. Some areas developed later. At the moment, there are 6 witch camps in 2 of the northern region. And that is where the witch camps are. The oldest is the Gambaga witch camp. One of the witch camps was actually established by a chief. And all these witch camps are around shrines, except the one I'm talking about now, which was established by a chief who was very progressive in those days in his own ways and just made an announcement that any woman who was accused of witchcraft and they make it to his jurisdiction, that woman is safe. So women who heard that started running to his place. And he provided them with a piece of land. And they started building their own huts there. And over time, that and bring into a camp. There is no haven that women who are kids can run to. And so the Roman Catholic Church has adopted that place and provided some kind of modicum of stronger structures for the women to stay in. But that's all that they can do. They are over 80, 90, sometimes 130 women at a time. And feeding them on a regular basis is just impossible for one organization to do. So the women have to fend for themselves. Apart from that camp, that is a genuine safe haven. All the other five camps are around shrines. That's where the witch hunting is taking place. Where they do the ritual to the Temusa witch. In this particular camp, they don't do that. It's a place that you run to for safety, and the Catholic Church is now there helping with the upkeep of the women.
When it's a private member's bill versus a government-sponsored bill, if it passes, then does the outcome look different? Is that part of a holdup?
When it's a government-sponsored bill, it will impose some financial obligations on the state. For instance, like the state should make sure the women are resettled. The state should make sure the women are provided with psychological and mental health care. It will impose some financial obligations on the state. And that is why the government initially said they were just interested in sponsoring it as a government bill. But if it's a private member's bill, you have to make sure the bill is crafted carefully that it doesn't impose any of this on the state. And that was what the bill did. So the bill was carefully drafted to avoid putting some of these financial burdens on the public purse, on public resources. And the bill imposes things on accusers to take care of the medical needs of the victim, and where there's a prison sentence, it is imposed along those lines. And where the accuser doesn't have the resources to do that, they have to find ways of selling their property or confiscating their property to take care of the victims. So all of those are in the bill just to avoid it imposing financial burdens on public purse. That is the difference between the private member's bill and the government-sponsored bill. But now, for some reason, the president, when the parliament passed the bill, it made big headlines in Ghana and internationally. And Ghana was being praised, and the presidency felt like they were left out of the praises. And they felt like this is something that maybe the government should have done. And it also just tells us how disengaged our politicians are. Because this has been going on for 3 years, and our presidency apparently didn't know until the bill was put on his desk to sign. And he's like, why didn't I know about this? Why was it not sponsored by government? So it looks like if the president knew from the get-go, the bill would have been sponsored by the government. Somewhere said that the bill could not government-sponsored bill.
We can definitely understand those intricacies of proposed bills. But when you're looking at one that is for the lives of these women and children and the overall health of family units,
it's by design or whatever that we are doing this interview today. Something that is actually gut-wrenching, that politicians will play politics with very vulnerable, innocent lives. And they give priority where they shouldn't be given priorities to. But that is African politics. The poor, vulnerable, the weak, nobody cares about them. Literally, nobody cares. Even when we were sponsoring and fighting for this bill, the churches couldn't care less. Even churches couldn't care less. We had to raise the funding from outside of Ghana to sponsor the bill. It makes it very difficult. But we are not giving up.
Yeah.
We will see you to the end. That is a promise I made to the lady who was lynched, her son. I told the children that we are going to make sure this bill is passed in honor of that lady. And that's what we are working on.
Yeah. It's remarkable the collaboration that you have had with other organizations and leaders. Do you want to tell us about any of the people you're working with or the organization you represent?
As I said, I'm working from the Sana Institute, which is a research institute in matters of religion and how religious belief affects society. And like you said, Sarah, this witchcraft belief affects the most damaging part of it is the family unit. It breaks up families. Even where the women don't end up in the camps and it's just mere suspicion and accusation at the home, it breaks family units up. Marriages are broken because of accusations and suspicion. And all kinds of terrible things have happened to break up families. And because of that, it became a very important part of our work. Religious belief that impinges on society so directly and so negatively. We took it up because of that. And we teamed up with other human rights organizations like Amnesty International. There is another NGO in Ghana called Action Aid Ghana. We're working with them also. And there's another group called Women in Law. It's a group of female lawyers and Ghanaian female lawyers. And we're working with them. And we have other gender activist groups who are passionate about gender-based violence and discrimination against women. Because this is purely discrimination against women. As I said, we sought partners from some individual members of parliament because we needed individual parliamentarians to take the bill up to say they would be the sponsors. We were able to get parliamentarians from across the party political divide, and they agreed to work together on the bill. They did the work with the drafting of the bill, and we participated and worked with them every step of the way. From the very first day of the meeting to draft the bill, we were there. Through to the end, till the day that they sat in parliament to vote on the bill, we were there, cheering and praying. And then we got to pass unanimously, only for the president to start dragging his feet on it. We've worked with different groups. And as I said, we also work with some of our partners overseas. There's a women, an Asian women's group in the United States. They reached out to us and said, we are happy to support this bill. They gave us a grant. That was what we used to sponsor the parliamentary work to get the bill across the line by parliament. And as I said, also, we're working with embassies and ambassadors and consulates. The United States Embassy is one of those that are working with us behind the scenes. And they have to do it discreetly because when they show their faces publicly, it can backfire. So we said to them, you leave the media and the frontline activism to us. We are Ghanaians. We can do that. And then you do the back behind the scenes, closed door, telephone calls, pressure on parliamentarians, on politicians. And they have been very effective in that. And that is what has helped us. So it's bringing all these groups together that has helped us. And we've got some very powerful allies, some individual opinion leaders in different communities who have been very supportive of what we are doing. And that has all helped us to get to where we are today.
Over the last few years, have there been programs initiated to treat the women medically, psychologically, in the witch camps?
Very good question. Yes and no. There's a general program that have been designed for the poor and needy for medical care. And the women are grouped under that kind of category. But because of the stigma, they can't even go to these health facilities. Because they have to still go to the health facilities to access these services. And because of the stigma, they are unable to go. Those who brave it are able to brave it and go. But when they get to these places, they are still shun people, look at them and move away from them, and all kinds of attitudes that are just not helping the matters. And so there's that kind of program that government has instituted, not specifically for the women, but for the poor and needy. And these women come under the poor and needy, but they are not able to access this. What some individual NGOs have also done is to take the medical services to the women in the camps, to get some doctor from time to time to visit them there, examine them and provide them with some needs, and treatment and those kinds of services. But for them to go to the hospital, the public hospital, it's been a challenge for most of them.
Is that shunning them, that includes medical workers unwilling to treat the witches, alleged?
Generally, the medical workers, when the women show up, will treat them.
Okay.
Even if they are apprehensive and suspicious, they will treat them. But it is just the public, the public. We have been going to these camps, interact with these women, and people are like, we are afraid for you. You are going to these women are witches, and you are going to sit with them. You sometimes go and eat with them. You sing with them. Are you sure they are not going to bewitch you? And we say, we don't think so. So we have been going. But there are people who are genuinely feared, who are afraid to go there or to have them in their company.
Yeah. I was just curious if that perceived fear of the evil going back to the communities of these camps aren't separating out the accused, how big a influence that is on the change.
Oh, yes. And that is why we will resettle them gradually over time, because the fear is there. We have been up there to engage with the community. And the traditional witch doctors will tell you that they can cure the women of the witchcraft, and they can perform rituals to cure the women. So we, as the community members, what we do is the doctors can cure them. So if they cure them, why can't they come back home? And then they will say, because we don't trust them. We still don't trust them. We still fear. We are still afraid that they will not be completely cured. The fear is there. But sometimes one of the things I forgot to mention, even the traditional priest told us that a lot of the accusations is just out of pure malice and envy and jealousy. That is what even the priests themselves tell us. And so in some cases, when people get a change of heart and they realize that they have caused enough harm, then they go back to these women in the camps and apologize and ask them to come back home. On some occasions, that has happened. In other occasions, too, the women may be asked to come back home, but feel so angry and betrayed that they just don't want to go back to that kind of community again. Because they're like, we've lived with you all these years, and you've come to destroy my life to this extent, and you want me to come back there and do what? Frustration and anger, and that kind of resentment. Some of the women don't want the pain. They don't want to go back there because they are going to be reminded on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So the fear is there, the pain on the part of the women is there, and just in other cases too, some of the women are sick, they are infirm, they are just not able to take care of themselves, even when they go back home. And some of them have been in the camps for too long that they don't even have no proper relation back home. Yeah. There are some of the women who have been in these camps for over 40, 50 years. They spend their lives in the camp. So such a woman, you tell them to go home, where is home? So it's quite complicated.
Yeah.
But the number of them, the majority will go back home if they get the chance. The majority will go back home. Yeah. One of the plans for the reintegration phase is preparing the community to receive the women, dealing with their fears and their suspicions. And we have been able to facilitate some of the women going back to their communities. We tell the women, when you feel it's safe for you to go back home, let us know, and we will facilitate it. They can tell you when it's safe for them to go back and when it's not. Mm-hmm. And when they come to us and say, we think it's safe for us to go back, Then we go to the community, we engage with the community chief, the local opinion leaders, the local government authorities there, and we make sure that we cover all those bases before the woman goes back home, so that there will be eyes on the woman for her safety and her welfare. And we make the woman know that there's help. If you feel unsafe, call on this person or let this person get to know. And they have our numbers, they can call. So we put in those measures in place for before we let them go because of the fear. Otherwise, we've had occasions where the women have gone back and they have been re-accused. And some have been killed by some unforgiving accusers who are still living there in the villages. And they go back and then they go and murder them in the night, in the middle of the night. We are very careful sending them back so that we don't send them back to their death.
And now for Minute with Mary.
Magistrate Jonathan Corwin was present at the pretrial examinations at Salem, Massachusetts in 1692. Though his presence loomed large in the Cramps Tavern and later the meeting house, he usually took a back seat to John Hathorne's harsh interrogations. The Corwin House still stands today at the corner of Essex and North Street at Salem. Ironically, Daniel Andrews was called upon to finish building the house when Corwin purchased the property in 1675. Daniel Andrews was accused of witchcraft in 1692 and fled, only returning to the area probably in 1693. If Daniel had not fled, he would have faced his former employer at the court of Oyer and Turner. The Corwin House is better known as the Witch House and is open to the public. Call the staff at 978-744-8915 for more information. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Sarah has End Witch Hunts News.
End Witch Hunts News. Accused witches of Ghana find refuge in camps to escape death. In the West, we have referred to these places of refuge as witch camps. Fleeing home to such a place guarantees the decline in the quality of life, but it is a potential escape from death. Stakes couldn't be higher. The issue of community banishment ties into a long history of such persecutions worldwide. Records show that in New England, women and sometimes couples were formally banished over witchcraft allegations by court magistrates. Often, accused witches of New England were victims of formal community banishment before and after a witchcraft trial. Many women who faced witch trials were in fact lost to history once arrested for witchcraft accusations. Dorothy Good, a young child during the Salem witch trials, was repeatedly formally forced out of communities until her death. Being labeled and left to fend for oneself is a deep form of rejection. It's not just a temporary exclusion, but a permanent severance from communal support during times of crisis. Consider what actions you can take to challenge and prevent such practices of banishment within your own community. Always stand against the practice of isolating individuals, and always strive to include and support those who are being pushed aside. Make every effort to offer safe spaces. Thank you for offering kindness to those in your community. Thank you for continuing to have this discussion with your circle of influence.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Witch Hunt.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more about Ghana's witch camps, listen to our February 20th, 2024 episode titled Caring for the Mental Health of Women in Ghana's Witch Camps with Peter Minter Amadou.
And join us next week as we begin our Salem Witch Hunt 101 series.
Thank you.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.